Well, Matt, and welcome to episode 107, the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for July 19th, 2015. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and in this podcast, we continue our two-month-long discussion of Troilus and Cressida. I know, it's been a while. 3 weeks instead of our customary two, but frankly, I was having trouble coming up with a subject that I could sink my teeth into, and I think I found it. This week, we're going to discuss a little misogyny. Sometimes, when you read a play, especially without having seen it or heard it before, something hits you. It sticks in your brain. You just get this vibe. It might not be real. It's, well, a feeling. And like all feelings, while it might be based on evidence that's in the text, it might not be a legitimate conclusion. But it would be a shame not to dive a little deeper into it, right? Such is the case of Troilus and Cressida, and the second biggest vibe I got from it, beyond the cynicism that I've been writing about for much of the last month. And that concept is misogyny. Now, our old buddy, the Oxford English Dictionary, defines misogyny as hatred or dislike of or prejudice against women. This is a word, by the way, that didn't even exist in Shakespeare's day. The word may not have existed, but that vibe sure did. It doesn't take long for it to rear its pretty little head. In only the third non-choric speech of the play, lovesick Troilus describes himself to Pandarus. But I am weaker than a woman's tear, tamer than sleep, fonder than ignorance, less valiant than the virgin in the night, and skillless as unpracticed infancy. So Troilus is weaker than a woman's tear, and so begins a string of comparisons. Sleep, ignorance, a virgin, a babe. This equation of women to these less than aware, smart, seasoned concepts is just the beginning of the contempt for women shown in the play. The reduction of women continues with Aeneas' delivery of Hector's challenge to the Greeks, a heroic, courtly love single combat, one which, if not accepted, will mean that the Grecian dames are sunburnt and not worth the splinter of a lance. Women are thus to be cataloged, either fair or sunburnt, dark, and ugly, and valued, either worthy of starting a war over, or less than a piece of trash, a leftover splinter from a broken and thus useless weapon. This concept of worth continues as the Trojan sons of Priam discuss the latest peace offering from Hector. The men debate Helen's value. A thing not ours nor worth to us, had it our name the value of 110. She is not worth what she doth cost the keeping. Is she worth keeping? Why, she is a pearl. Helen's worth is in her value, monetary or symbolic. There's no emotion there, no mention of love, not even when Paris speaks of her. She is not his love or his wife, she is his possession, the thing that you desire to buy. Later, we will learn that Cressida too has worth. Diomedes tells Troilus of Cressida, to her own worth she shall be prized. If women have worth, then what is it? How great can it be? When a man is called a woman, it's meant as an insult. When we first meet the scurrilous Greek Thersites, Ajax calls him Mistress Thersites, a slam against the non-soldier's non-masculinity. Later, when Thersites refers to Patroclus as Achilles' brach, there is no other way to take it than as an insult. As I wrote earlier in my discussion of homosexuality in the play, brach was a term of abuse meaning bitch, which in turn not only meant dog when applied to a man, but also a lewd or sensual woman. So in one word, Thersites is able to insult both a man in particular and women in general. I've discussed the commentary this Thersites brings to the play, so it's interesting that while the opening chorus refers to the kidnapped queen as the ravished Helen, she's nothing more than a prostitute for Thersites. All the argument of the war is a whore and a cuckold. A whore, a woman with no value, only a price. Something as disposable as an undergarment. Remember, Thersites calls this conflict a war for a placket, which Eric Partridge, in his Shakespeare's Body, describes as an opening in, or the opening of, a petticoat, placed in contiguity with the pudend, or vagina. The war is for a woman, or more specifically, for just a part of a woman. If a woman is like a petticoat, a piece of clothing, then she is reduced to what Paris talked about earlier, a possession. This concept comes up again when we meet Cressida's father, the traitor priest Calchas, who tells the Greek commanders, "I have abandoned Troy but left my possession." What he refers to as having left behind is not his house, but rather Cressida. And he asks that the newly captured Trojan leader be sent, and he shall buy my daughter. His daughter is worth the enemy leader, he feels, and can be purchased. He may be right, but only if the leader in question has value, or, for lack of a better term, a manly man. As Patroclus tells Achilles, a woman impudent and mannish grown is not more loathed than an effeminate man. Now, whether or not this is just Patroclus's manifestation of guilt over Achilles' fallen, dare we say it, value to the Greek command, the perception is real, and Achilles can only admit, "I have a woman's longing." By having a woman's longing, Achilles is less than a real man. A woman in Troilus and Cressida is not a character. She is a type. A whore, Helen. A crazy woman, Cassandra. A betrayer of men, Cressida. A harpy, Andromache. Or absent altogether, Hecuba. And a type is but a thing. Thus, a woman is a thing. And like Hamlet's statement of Claudius, the king's a thing, it's reductive and scornful. So being a thing, not a good thing. Now, let's move from the general to the specific, and Cressida. If women can be reduced to types, then Cressida will become what she predicts, as false as Cressid. However, one can't be false from the beginning. It must be a reaction to, a refutation of some truth. So in her first scene, we see her in her natural verbal state, giving as good as she gets with her uncle, the body Pandarus. As noted in the Bodiness podcast, Cressida is playful with her language, discussing how she could recognize a man after she knew him, with not only the casual but sexual connotation of the verb. Pandarus refers to Troilus as not come to it yet, meaning he hadn't reached maturity, with a sexual implication that Troilus is a virgin. Cressida has confidence, though, that Troilus will succeed with the necessary erection, stand to the proof, even if it means that Troilus has a sexually transmitted disease. When Pandarus attempts to make Cressida jealous by noting how Helen praised Troilus, Cressida responds, "I had as lief Helen's golden tongue had commended Troilus for a copper nose." False noses and other body parts were made of pliable metals to cover areas that had been decayed through venereal diseases. She's bawdy, and not above a catty insult upon another woman either. During Pandarus's ongoing teasing of Cressida, saying that he thinks that Helen may love Troilus better than Paris, she responds, "Then she's a merry Greek indeed." Not only is this a little female-on-female verbal violence, but an insult of ethnic superiority as well. Later in the scene, when Pandarus asks Cressida what seasons a man, she responds that a pie needs to be seasoned with dates, the fruit, but if a man is not seasoned, then the man's date is out, or past his sexual prime. This is so whip-smart that even Pandarus notes, "You are such a woman that a man knows not at what ward you lie," meaning she's so sharp-witted that a man would not know what mode of parrying and fencing she takes. Any connection between her sharp wit and the body meaning of keen is purely coincidental, I'm sure. Not. Now, at this point, I can almost see a bit of Much Ado's Beatrice in Cressida, but then her response is nothing but bawdiness. "If I cannot ward what I would not have hit, I can watch you for telling how I took the blow, unless it's swell past hiding, and then it's past watching." What is not hit is her virginity. Taking the blow is losing said virginity, and swelling is the pregnancy that follows. This is the natural course for Cressida. Sex is the goal. Very unlike Beatrice. Love is secondary. As Cressida admits, "I show more craft than love." Craft. Can it be any surprise, then, that this is the woman who will become the poster child for falsehood? From Cressida in her opening state, let's move to the woman at the heart of the war that frames our play, Helen. Even before we meet her, we hear her worth and value being debated by King Priam and his sons, including her kidnapper Paris. As I noted earlier in this podcast, all this worthy talk points more to the possession and objectification of members of the gender. And for Helen, it's about to get worse. Helen appears in only one scene, Act 3, Scene 1. But before we and Pandarus see her, we get a bit of bawdy banter between Cressida's uncle and Paris's servant. As I noted in that bawdy podcast, The servant calls Pandarus's seething business sodden, a stewed phrase, with a stew relating to a brothel, according to Eric Partridge. In the very next speech, with Paris and Helen's entrance, Pandarus greets her with "Fair Queen," which is nice enough, but the servant and the audience, privy to the previous exchange about brothels, would note the homophone of queen, Q-U-E-A-N, which meant prostitute. Once the pleasantries of greeting have been made, Pandarus attempts to ask Paris to cover for Troilus' absence in that evening's family dinner, but he keeps getting interrupted. Pandarus begins, "Well, sweet queen, you are pleasant with me, but marry thus, my lord, my dear lord and most esteemed friend, your brother Troilus," Helen, "my lord Pandarus, honey sweet lord," Pandarus, "go to, sweet queen, go to, commends himself most affectionately to you," Helen interrupts, "you shall not bob us out of our melody. If you do, our melancholy upon your head." Pandarus, sweet queen, that's a sweet queen, i'faith. Helen, "and to make a sweet lady sad is a sour offense." Pandarus, "nay, that shall not serve your turn, that shall it not, in truth law. Nay, I care not for such words, no, no. And my lord, he desires you that if the king call for him at supper, you will make his excuse." Helen, "my lord Pandarus," Pandarus, "what says my sweet queen, my very, very sweet queen?" Paris, "what exploits in hand? Where sups he tonight?" Helen, "nay, but my lord..." Now it feels that there's something weird going on here. Helen keeps cutting Pandarus off. First, his two lines of the section are cut off mid-sentence, and his third is cut off without expressing any thought save for referring to Helen. Even his fourth, which is his longest line of the section, is a jumble. First, a response to Helen, and then finally a completion of his request to Paris. She is relentless and rude in her request for a song. And while I suppose the sequence could be played with Helen either imperiously or impetuously interrupting Pandarus, I think there's a physical bent to this as well. I see her interrupting him with touches and caresses, grabs and hugs, attempting to use her body to get what she wants. I think this concept of sexualized physicality is supported by her body response to Pandarus's statement that Cressida and Troilus are not a couple, that they are separate, twain. And she says, "Falling in after falling out may make them three." Here she's saying that the makeup sex, falling in, after the breakup, falling out, can cause a pregnancy, make them three. Like for Cressida earlier, sex is the goal for Helen. That makes the reading of Helen's last speech hypersexualized as well. When Paris asks her to help unarm our Hector with her white enchanting fingers, she responds, "'Twill make us proud to be his servant, Paris. Yea, what he shall receive of us in duty gives us more palm in beauty than we have. Yea, overshines ourself." What duty shall he receive from Helen? I'm sure there's a clean way to read this, but trying to think of what will give her more palm than what she already has leads me only to a sexualized, handy reading. Of course, it doesn't help, in hindsight, that from this point on she is only mentioned in the most degraded of terms. As Diomedes talks of her soilure, her dishonor, every false drop in her body veins, her contaminated carrion weight. She is a dirty, dirty girl, but influential as well, as we will see how Cressida grows more Helen-like. Now, when we last left Cressida, we had just seen her in her natural, pre-false verbal state, a more sexualized version of the whip-smart Beatrice from Much Ado, quick-witted yet with sex as a goal. Now, once that coupling has taken place through the machinations of Pandarus the Pander, we learn that she is to be traded to the Greeks in exchange for the captured leader and tenor. The news is delivered quickly, brutally, to Troilus, whose immediate response is it concluded so? How my achievements mock me. There is no attempt to forestall, no attempt to fight for her. She is merely property, that which can be taken from him. His acceptance comes so easily. Compare this to one of the possible reasons why Achilles doesn't fight, the stealing of his war prize. When the lovers part, they exchange tokens. He gives her his sleeve, she gives him her glove. Now, I've wondered before if we should have known Cressida would be untrue by her choice of token. Troilus gives her a sleeve, an article of clothing that fits only one body part, the arm, while Cressida gives him a glove into which five fingers fit. It would make sense if we take the implication that Troilus would be monogamous and Cressida not so much. All of this is prelude, in my opinion, to the strangest scene in the play, Cressida's arrival at the Greek camp and her welcome by the commanders. Now, it's a long scene, and I'm not going to read all of it. I'm just going to talk a little bit about how it breaks down. In my book of the play, I have scribbled near the top of this scene, "Yuck," and underlined it, and I stand by that assessment. Agamemnon kisses her first, but how? Hell, all of these could be simple courtly kisses of her hand, but there's no text to support that, and in a bit I'll get to the text that supports its opposite. These are full-mouthed kisses, but for how long? Is it a short peck or a long, drawn-out snog? Agamemnon's line is full iambic pentameter, so the argument could go either way. However, the line does end with a feminine ending, lady, which often metrically pushes a speech into the next line. So I would argue this is a long kiss, a really long one. Now, maybe she resists and Nestor's following comment comes during the kiss, or maybe she doesn't and his comment is one of condensation afterwards. Ulysses then puns on Nestor's use of the word general, saying that the kindness of the kiss was particular to Agamemnon and it would be better if she were kissed by all, kissed in general. So following Agamemnon's long kiss and Ulysses' statement, it's no surprise that the other leaders line up for their satisfaction. Nestor's kiss line is a short one, so I'd argue that his kiss is long as well. Next is Achilles. His line is still not a full iambic pentameter, but it's longer than Nestor's. Thus, his kiss is shorter than Nestor's, but still no mere peck. Now, does this shortening of his kiss metrically support the interpretation of Achilles as homosexual? Maybe. I think so, because the next kiss comes from Achilles' brach. After a full iambic pentameter line, I'd say this is a short one, again, supporting the homosexual angle. Leading up to and during this kiss is some locker room-style trash talk at the expense of Menelaus, the cuckold. When Patroclus first kisses Cressida, it is for Menelaus. The second kiss is for Patroclus himself. Coming as it does at midline, the break in a perfect antilab shared between lines by Patroclus and Menelaus. This must be another quick kiss. And this is where it gets weird. Menelaus voices his desire for a kiss, and it is only then, for the first time in the scene, that Cressida speaks, asking Menelaus, "In kissing, do you render or receive?" She'll be kissed, it seems, by generals, old pervs, and bi and gay men alike, but she draws the line and speaks up when it's a professed cuckold who is about to lay lips on her. What follows is a 10-line exchange, filled with antilabs, sometimes seen as the metrical example of romantic compatibility, pauses, and rhymes. If you pulled those 10 lines out of context, it could easily be seen as flirtation, on the level of Beroun and Rosaline, of Benedict and Beatrice, Petruchio and Kate, Hotspur and his Kate. It's fun! But very strange in this context, as if Cressida has resigned herself to the situation and is now playing along, you know, more evidence of her craft. Her flirtation continues with Ulysses in another exchange with an antilab and more rhymes. Here, Ulysses even answers her line with a rhyme, "do and you." This dialogue continues to layer on the weirdness, and Diomedes, the only character on stage that doesn't get a kiss or ask for one, irony alert, takes her away. Nestor says Cressida has quick sense, which could mean that she's smart, and he recognizes her decision to go along with the perversity to save herself, or that she's sexually fast. Ulysses responds with what every entitled but unsatisfied male says. She wants it. He sees that her spirits are wanton and that her lip speaks the language of sexuality. And it is this lip reference that makes me believe that all of the kisses leading up to this are fully mouthed kisses, not simple pecks of her cheek or her hand. Ulysses has watched kisses both rendered and received. He knows what a sluttish daughter looks like, and Cressida fits the bill. And we are one step closer to her becoming the poster child for Heart of Falsehood. When we next see Cressida, we are set for a Rashomon-like moment. We will hear what Troilus and Ulysses say about what they're seeing transpiring between Cressida and Diomedes. We'll hear Thersites' commentary on both the actions of and reactions to the Trojan drab, and we'll get to form our own opinions about what's going on. When Cressida whispers something to Diomedes, and Troilus asks if she can be so familiar with him so soon, we get this double commentary. Ulysses says, "She will sing any man at first sight." And then Thersites says, "And any man may sing her, if he can get her clef, she's noted." While Ulysses' response is fairly innocent, she will sing the first time she's with a man, or she can read a man on first sight, like a musician can sight read music, Thersites takes Ulysses' musical metaphor and runs with it, saying that she's notorious, noted, because any man can sing her if he gets her clef, like a musical clef, but also a cleft or a split or a slit, or any female part that may look like a slit. When Cressida tells Diomedes, "Sweet honey Greek, tempt me no more to folly," it's a mixed message for Troilus. On the one hand, she calls him sweet honey Greek, but on the other, she tells him to stop tempting her, implying that he has done so in the past, but she has not given in. When Thersites then comments, "Roguery, though," it sets up both Troilus and us to believe the worst. And we get the worse, as Diomedes says that she has forsworn some act. Of course, Thersites cannot let this revelation go without a comment. "A juggling trick, to be secretly open!" Implying that they're witnessing some kind of magic trick where she appears chaste, secret, while being wanton, open. While this statement further prepares us to believe the worst, we hear her admit to swearing an oath, which she no longer wants to keep, causing a frustrated Diomedes to exclaim, "I'll be your fool no more." She now appears to be manipulating two men simultaneously, Troilus and Diomedes. Ulysses, almost playing the anti-Pandarus, wants to separate Troilus, and by extension us, from the scene. But it's to no avail. Shakespeare wants us to see and hear what comes next. Diomedes too wants to leave, but she gives him a come hither statement, literally, and then, to Troilus' dismay, strokes Diomedes' cheek. Troilus is fighting a losing battle with his composure. It's hard to witness for him and us. Of course, it doesn't help that Thersites is using such sexually provocative innuendo as fat rump and potato finger. Everything has been tainted with a grotesque sexuality. We want to think the best of Cressida, though from all we know even before the play begins that this won't turn out well. But when she gives as a token to Diomedes the very sleeve Troilus had given her, it's crushing. Sure, she immediately wants it back, calling herself a false wench, but all this does incite Diomedes' passion further. When Thersites then says, "Now she sharpens, well said, whetstone," all we as an audience can do is remember Sharp's sexualized connotation of arousal and think back to Cressida's own self-evaluation. "I show more craft than love," and how she told us that men prize the thing ungained more than it is. Our conclusion can only be that this is an act, a craft to inflame Diomedes. And it works on both sides. Diomedes stays for a while for more fooling, and then alone, seemingly, Cressida admits, "Troilus, farewell. One eye yet looks on thee, but with my heart the other eye doth see." There's nothing left to do now save come to the realization that his Cressida is the same as Diomed's Cressida. He cannot convince himself otherwise, try as he might. He says, "Let it not be believed for womanhood. Think we had mothers. Do not give advantage to stubborn critics, apt, without a theme for deprivation, to square the general sex by Cressid's rule. Rather, think this not Cressid." Ulysses responds, "What hath she done, prince, that can soil our mothers?" And Troilus says, "Nothing at all, unless this were she." No. The judgment is obvious. This is false Cressid, false, 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 a commodious drab, a whore in Thersites' words. Cressida is a whore. Helen is a slut. Cassandra, a madwoman. Andromache, a harpy trying to keep Hector at home. And Hecuba completely absent. How's that for womanhood? Yeah, it almost feels as if Shakespeare, in Troilus and Cressida, is president of our gang's He-Man Woman Haters Club.
"Now what do you say if we form a new club and call it the He-Man Woman Haters Club?"
Saturday night, my wife and son and I went to Los Angeles's Griffith Park to catch the summer production of Romeo and Juliet by the Independent Shakespeare Company. Every summer, they present two free Shakespeare plays outdoors over the course of the summer. Hashtag Shakespeare Set Free. Later this summer, it'll be Much Ado About Nothing, which sounds great, but you still have one last chance to check out Romeo and Juliet before it closes at the end of the month. Longtime readers of the blog know that Romeo and Juliet is pretty much my favorite play. Having taught it so much, I've got a soft spot for it. So my expectations are high, very high. So bound for disappointment, right? Not so much. Is it a perfect production? Of course not. There's no such thing. But this is a vibrant, loud, boisterous, at times histrionic version. Exactly like the play. First of all, as befitting a timeless play, its setting is timeless. Mercutio is decked out in tights straight out of Commedia dell'arte. Benvolia, a woman here, is new wave, possibly from sometime in the next decade. Others seem day-glow Edwardian. And all of it is backed by an onstage band, a four-piece modern rock ensemble that the production calls the Lively Helenas, and plays something in between power pop and punk, but can then slow it down for a lovely musical interlude. It was very effective. At intermission, I told my wife that the actor playing Mercutio, Andre Martin, should be arrested. She looked at me quizzically. I couldn't possibly mean that he was so awful that it was criminal, right? No. He should have been arrested for grand larceny, stealing every scene he was in. Brilliant, witty, bawdy, but then turn on a dime, sarcastically thoughtful. It's a great performance, especially when he went out into the crowd for his speeches, interplaying with the audience. It would be hard for anyone to live up to that performance, but Erica Soto's Juliet does just that. Playful, she uses her body to show how young this woman is, not yet physically used to living in her own skin. It would have been a great performance even if she had never opened her mouth, but she did, and it was wonderful. Full command of the text, a great song interlude, and completely appropriate histrionics. Now, normally, I don't like that sort of screaming, but here it worked, primarily because she had laid the groundwork for it earlier through her dynamic physical performance. Friar Lawrence is played by Indie Shake's co-founder and member of the Lively Helenas, he wrote the score for the play as well, David Melville. He brought something new, at least for me, to the role, a kind of quicksilver comic relief. His line to Romeo that they stumble who run fast seems to apply to him as well, since it's his jumping at the chance of bringing the feud to an end, of coming up with an escape for Romeo, of trying to fake Juliet's death. Well, he stumbles as well. I'm not sure how much of these choices were honed by director Melissa Chalsma, another of the company's co-founders. Melville is her husband. Regardless, she deserves kudos for crafting a very good production of what can easily be a cliched piece. Did I love everything? No, of course not. There were some technical sound issues that were annoying. The removal of the Lady Montague character, in my opinion, takes away from the whole concept that the three major families of the play are all equally struck down by the fates. But her absence may explain in a pop psychological way Romeo's fickle nature. Overall, it is a great night of theater, not to be missed, but you have only one weekend left. And get there early. The crowd we were with on Saturday is much larger than the ones we saw last summer. You will not be sorry. Unless, of course, you miss this. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries the last couple of weeks, you've missed out on subjects including contra-predictive expectations and questions, Commentators Part 1, Prologue, Commentators Part 2, Thersites, Commentators Part 3, Pandarus, some random questions, an Ollie workshopping ideas segment, Florid Speech Part 1, Florid Speech Part 2, running the numbers, Scansion for acting clues, we pause this entry for, Troilus and Cressida stage directions in the dialogue, The Problem of Achilles, our capsule review of Romeo and Juliet by the Independent Shakespeare Company at Griffith Park in Los Angeles, Misogyny in General, Misogyny, The Case of Cressida, Part 1, Misogyny, Helen, The Fair Queen, not a typo, Misogyny, The Case of Cressida, Part 2, and misogyny, the case of Cressida Part the Last, putting her to bed. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page and our Twitter feed. But remember that those social media outlets are more for Shakespeare news and notes than for discussions of our current play under study. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And join us again next week. Yeah, I know it's either feast or famine around here. For our next podcast, when we kill off our discussions of Troilus and Cressida with a concept and a casting, a wrap-up, and a few final thoughts. Hope to see you then. Been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for July 19th, 2015. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com, and we shall see thee anon.